This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To search for other podcasts you might like, click bbc.co.uk/5live,
where you'll also find our terms of use.
Hello Outriders. This week I've been learning about a neat app for blind and partially sighted people. I've checked out music made about hackers, and our own Chris Valance has been finding out about robot warfare. So if you're sitting comfortably, then let's begin with an app that combines technology and volunteering. Be My Eyes is in development at the moment, and it hooks up people who are blind or partially sighted with volunteers who can see and help them out. Now, having a mobile device around these days means having a pocket full of tools that you can use for daily tasks. We might check the weather or glance at the news and get train times before we leave for work. So why not have a handy tool that can help people see? Hans Weiberg is usually found working as an upholsterer in Denmark, but he's also a chairman for blind people in his region. And so he worked with the team to create something to help out. Here's what he told me.
We try to make a service where blind people can download our app to iPhone. When they launch the app, they will be connected to a group of volunteers that can help them perform some task. It's kind of like Skype, where the helper can see what the blind person is aiming at with the iPhone. And for instance, if you are in your kitchen and you have two cans and they are filled alike, but you don't know what's in them, then you can launch our app, and then the helper can tell you what can is what.
So it makes a video connection so that the helper can see what's going on.
Both video and audio. So you can talk about it, and the helper can say, for instance, if you have to turn the can around, if the text is on the other side.
How did this idea start? What was the inspiration?
I'm chairman for the blind people in my region in Denmark here. I know a lot of blind people, and I saw this need, and then I have an iPhone myself, and I discovered that it should be possible to make this work. I haven't been able to find someone who has done it, so I have to do it myself with my team. I went to a startup weekend here in Denmark, and I joined up with 8 other people who are very dedicated to help me make this.
Were they able to create an application within the weekend?
No, but later on we have a developer into our team, and he has been able to make a prototype. We are not in the App Store yet, but we hope to be. We try to raise some money because you need to buy some developer, and they are quite expensive.
How have the blind people that you know reacted to this idea? Are they intrigued?
Yes, the Danish Blind Society has supported us with £5,000. In Sweden, we have won a competition where we won another £4,000. We have quite a few supporters, blind supporters, in our Facebook group.
What is it like finding volunteers who are happy to do this? Because I'm guessing the volunteers who are using the app to help blind people see things need to be kind of on call.
The service is not up and running yet, so we have to see if we can get the volunteers to be volunteers. But I think, for instance, blind people's brothers and sisters and parents and so on will be likely to sign up as helpers. So I imagine that all of us can share each other friends for this service here. And then later on, I imagine that, ordinary people, so to speak, will join in as well.
I guess it works not only with the technology of being able to see through someone else's phone and help them, but also as a kind of social network.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, exactly. It's not meant as a chat function. If you're blind and you live alone, you might ask your neighbor once in a while to help you out, but you don't want to ask him 5 times a day. Mm-hmm. And you might have a little need sometimes 5 times a day. And then this service should be very handy to have in your pocket.
And so will this help then with independence?
Yeah, for instance, if you are doing some cooking and you are uncertain if what is what, then you can just have this service help you. and in a very short time. You don't have to wait till someone is available or getting home from work or anything. You can do it right away. So that will certainly help the daily life and to be more independent.
You're certainly creative with your furniture work as well, for making things. Is this the first time you've made something using technology like an iPhone?
Absolutely, the first time. I haven't done anything like this before, and it has been an amazing journey so far, because people have been very helpful about it, and it's very funny to tell about this story here, and so people really like it, and people are also signing up already on our webpage. So.
If people would like to sign up to find out more, whether they'd like some help themselves if they're blind or partially sighted, or indeed if they'd like to volunteer, where can they find more information online?
We have a website called bemyeyes.org, and it is non-profit. And these days we have a crowdfunding campaign on Indiegogo.com. And if you go into Indiegogo.com and search for Be My Eyes, you should be able to find our campaign, and I would be very grateful if someone was helping us.
We wish Hans and his team the best of luck with Be My Eyes. Now, one of the forefathers of Outriders, Chris Valance, has been playing with robots this week, and for once on A Robot Story, it's not my influence that made this happen. A campaign for a new international arms control treaty was launched last week, the aim to ban lethal autonomous weapons. So, Chris Valance went along to find out why some people think now is the time to pull the plug on robot war.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Laura Brothers. I'm from Article 36.
At the headquarters of Amnesty International, human rights organisations and advocates gathered to discuss a new arms control campaign.
We're very excited to be launching the campaign to stop killer robots.
That's the voice of Jodie Williams, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for her efforts to ban landmines.
And killer robots would be, you know, machines, lethal machines that can kill on their own with no human involvement.
Why is this a problem?
Think about a robot in a village in Afghanistan, and the robot is confronted with children, women, men in robes. How is that robot going to determine which one is the enemy?
But at the moment, that's science fiction, and for roboticist and campaign supporter Professor Noel Sharkey, there's one distracting bit of sci-fi that keeps coming back.
So whenever I do a newspaper interview, and the picture's always Arnold Schwarzenegger or some sort of ridiculous robot.
Like the vintage toy clockwork robots on Professor Sharkey's shelves, Terminator's a pure fantasy. His concern is rather with smart weapons that can select and attack targets on their own, autonomously.
And I should be really clear about what I mean by autonomous, because it really confuses both politicians and philosophers, because they think of free will. The question is really, who decides to fire the weapon?
So it's machines that can take the decision to pull the trigger.
Yes, exactly. And again, this would be more like if a heat signature detected, then fire a weapon.
Well, there are weapons with a level of autonomy that have already been used in operations for several years, in fact. I'm Elizabeth Quintana. I'm Senior Research Fellow for Air Power and Technology at the Royal United Services Institute. The most obvious example is the anti-radiation missiles, and these would look autonomously for air defence systems that would be switched on and off, and then they'd follow the radar signals and take out that particular defence system.
And what, campaigners ask, would happen if the enemy radar was on a hospital roof? Well, the Ministry of Defence, for its part, doesn't use fully autonomous systems. They say humans are always in charge.
My lords, the United Kingdom does not have fully autonomous weapons systems. Such systems are not yet in existence and are not likely to be for many years, if at all. There are currently a limited number of naval defensive systems which could operate in automatic mode.
Defence Minister Lord Astor told the House of Lords that there was always a human in charge.
But my lords, let's be absolutely clear, the operation of weapon systems will always, always be under human control.
Drones are one such high-tech system under human control. But according to Sir Brian Burridge, who works for aerospace and defence conglomerate Finmeccanica and is also a spokesperson for the industry, future generations of unmanned fighters would need a high degree of autonomy to survive in high-speed battles that would be beyond the capacity of a human pilot.
The degree to which we can see on the horizon an autonomous, stealthy, combat, uninhabited air vehicle, then it's starting to take shape and form.
But Sir Brian thinks systems like that are decades away and could only be deployed if they could work safely.
So you have to be able to satisfy the standard aspects of distinguishing a military target and humanity. I mean, that is absolutely the crux by which wars are fought by a nation like ours.
Can autonomous systems do that, though? Can they satisfy those requirements? I mean, can an autonomous drone distinguish between a plane, a munition, and a parachute?
Well, right now, no. And unless they can do that, they will have no efficacy. They will just have no use. So, you know, there is the technological challenge.
But Noel Sharkey thinks the technical challenges of doing that are overwhelming.
And for me, I know that vision systems, for instance, are really, really crude. I mean, we can just about tell the difference between a lion and a car at the moment. And we have humanoid detectors, but they get fooled by a statue or, that kind of thing. And so any weapon, you've got to be able to discriminate between a civilian and a combatant. And there's no way that these things could discriminate between a civilian and a soldier, even if the soldier's wearing uniform. I mean, if they were all wearing bright purple uniforms or bright red uniforms or something, then maybe we could do that. Or if all the Taliban agreed to wear radio frequency identity tags, you know, that sort of thing. But the other one is the notion that, you know, you can kill civilians providing you don't intend to. That's the laws of war, and I'm not keen on it, but that's the laws of war, and that's called proportionality. Now, there are PhD theses in the military academies about what does military advantage mean. It's a really difficult thing to work out. No robot or AI system could work that out, really.
And that brings us again into the realms of science fiction.
Can an overlord of ministers say, do not these machines contradict the first law of robotics, in the sense that they are identifying and killing human beings?
Lord Tanlaw, in that House of Lords discussion, referencing science fiction writer Isaac Asimov's Laws of Robotics. Daniel H. Wilson is a roboticist and sci-fi author.
So the Asimov's three laws of robotics were sort of a gimmick that he invented to tell some stories. So I think, let me get this right. The first is that a robot may not harm a human or through inaction allow a human to come to harm. The second rule is that it has to obey humans unless it conflicts with the first rule. And the third rule is that it has to protect itself unless that conflicts with any of the previous two rules. And intuitively, they make a lot of sense, but you have to remember they were created specifically so that Asimov could tell really interesting detective stories about how the rules were broken and crimes were committed. So they necessarily have flaws, you know, and even if the rules did perfectly work together, you still run into the perception problem, as in identifying a combatant.
But Daniel Wilson believes the case for military systems that are merely automatic is compelling.
You could consider the Phalanx close-in weapon system that's in use on Navy ships in a lot of countries all around the world, and those things are designed to shoot down missiles or jets that are coming in, you know, potentially faster than the speed of sound. And there's no human being that could react in time to save the ship. So I think autonomous weapons certainly have a place, although they obviously need to be very well regulated.
The unpredictability of fully autonomous weapon systems is why Elizabeth Quintana believes the military appetite for such systems is likely to remain limited.
I don't think at the moment there is a need to worry about putting a ban in place. I think the military are just as concerned with having fully autonomous systems. They wouldn't want it to be accidentally targeting the wrong people or the wrong building or the wrong system.
Or themselves.
Or themselves, yes. And so for the moment, there will always be a man in the loop. And as I said, there are going to be manned air assets for at least 30 years. So I think any effort to try and abolish them or ban them is somewhat preemptive.
So what should the rules on the use of autonomous systems be? Here's Sir Brian Burridge again.
My personal view is that the international community will gradually develop an understanding of where the threshold of what we might call robotic warfare ought to be set. And I think, you know, gradually this will come. But I do think that there will be, there is a certain level of appetite for this in the international community, and we just don't know where it is yet.
Well, at the end of last year, the US Defense Department issued policies on fully autonomous weapons. Many interpreted those as an effective moratorium. But for Jody Williams, a moratorium isn't enough.
Moratoriums are exactly that, you know, just limited time. If they choose tomorrow to get rid of their moratorium, they can. We want to see something permanent.
But in a world where every day human beings kill other human beings, convincing us of the need to restrain the robot menace may take some time.
Definitely the less cuddly side of robotics there. I'll be keeping an eye on our dancing vacuum cleaners to make sure that they're not considering some evolution. Turning a bit of a corner here, we have some music again this week, and a theme that is close to our hearts, hackers and coders. If you're fond of movies with hackers in them, then you're likely to see a few templates that might not reflect the reality of the many types of hackers and diversity through race and gender. You're likely to see a movie caricature, and it used to be mostly guys typing fast, working in dark rooms, while other people in some sort of control centre run around with their hands in the air shouting, OMG, they've hacked the mainframe. Not a lot like the diverse groups of people that I've come to know and respect for their work. I threw the question out over the weekend on our social networking pages, and well, it seems that you lot have noticed a lot of these stereotypes too. Mile on Facebook says, that's all there is, sadly. It's a mashup of several stereotype categories. Geeks and dorks, security hacker versus hacker in the sense of programmer, villains with ridiculous agendas. Over on Twitter, Jay sent us a link to a very funny page called Hacker Typer. When you open it up in your browser, it gives you a black screen, and when you start to type anything, it generates lines and lines of what looks like it could be code in a bright green font. From a distance, you'll look very productive, and of course it looks like the pages of code people work on when you see hackers on TV. Back on Facebook, and it looks as though we've found a trigger for Terence Eden. He says, more than stereotypes, it's the mistakes that annoy me. You can't have two people use a keyboard at the same time, nor can you trace an IP like you can a phone number, nor do cell phones have dial tones. I think some deep breaths there, Terence. It's never easy seeing a profession that you know about being mangled on the screen. But I've been finding out more about this through a slightly different route. Though it may set your teeth on edge from time to time, it can be kind of fun watching hacker movies. Lucky for us, we can relive some of the greats like Sneakers, War Games, Hackers and more via Eclectic Method. Johnny Wilson of the Eclectic Method Collective has made a supercut of Hackers in Movies, and so I asked him how he made it, and the templates that he saw repeated again and again.
It's a subject I wanted to do for a while. I like to do mixes where I pick themes that reoccur in many different films and you can piece together certain reoccurring themes. So the hacker mix was something I wanted to do for a while, and it seems a really poignant time to do it.
There seems a bit of a difference in the way that hackers are portrayed in film as opposed to the ones that we might know and love on the internet and further afield.
Yeah, I feel like they're also portrayed in the films like a mixture of lovable rogue and evil genius.
Did you see many stereotypes in the characters that are portrayed in the films that you saw?
Yeah, for sure. Fat dude in the basement, reoccurring one. A progress bar. They're always waiting for a progress bar to hit its end.
How many films did you end up watching to make your mix?
Oh, maybe about 40 or 50, but only ended up using about 30.
Still, that's quite a lot. I didn't realise there were quite so many films. How were you researching this? Were you asking people for their favourites, or is this like a back catalogue that you knew about?
Yeah, I always ask, like, on Eclectic Method's Facebook and Twitter page and get people's feedback. I do that a few times, and also just Googling it and then watching through loads of films. And a lot of these films are like James Bond movies where a hacker will occur only once or twice.
And so why do you think they continue with this stereotype? I mean, we've seen hackers in news reports, we've seen men and women who are self-identifying as hackers, and it doesn't, as you say, it doesn't seem to represent that fat dude in the basement.
Yeah, well, there's Swordfish, in which the hacker's really good-looking. I think also there's a huge explosion in the 90s of, like, the internet was becoming important, and there was lots of hackers and coders and programmers in those films. And then suddenly it seems like recently there's a lot less.
And so do you think this is a realization that you can't stress that stereotype anymore, and maybe film writers are struggling with how they might want to represent this?
Yeah, how do you make coding look interesting?
Were there any ways that you found that were interesting ways to portray coding rather than someone typing at a keyboard?
Well, most of it's about interacting with a computer, but I really loved a lot of the types of sounds and the variety of sounds from like the 80s, 90s, like the dial-up modem sounds, the sound of login screens, computers saying, yes, shall we play a game from War Games?
So do you think we've lost something then? If computing is becoming more efficient, but it also seems to be becoming silent, do you think we're missing out on sensory experience?
Yeah, I guess it's how they made loads of films about making films in early on and then didn't. It is background. It is human society now. So much of what we do is basically the internet, but that, how can you comment on it?
What were your favourites then out of all of these movies that you went through?
War Games is brilliant. I mean, I always, you know, I remember it from watching it when I was younger, but you forget how brilliant it is. It's really well written. There's great lines in it. It's hilarious.
How long did it take you then to turn 30 films into one mix?
Well, the longest amount of time is spent watching through them and trying to get a dialogue, although there's a website called Subzin where you can literally search for key phrases. But basically, the composing a piece of music and composing the video takes 3-4 days. Like, I like to mess around a bit to begin with instead of just, you know, cutting straight to the chase.
And so if our computing has changed and become more silent, and indeed hackers have become more efficient with the tools available to them, how have your processes changed? Because they must have become somewhat easier, but are you nostalgic for the old days and the way you had to mix before?
No. I think for what I've done is what I do now, I wouldn't really have a job or be able to like make art at home if it was the olden days. The internet's so important to me, it's become that I can distribute an idea from really cheap and through the internet super fast. It can handle a lot of, you know, booking shows and handling business and running everything from the website to social networking to how I communicate with people to releasing music and selling it on iTunes. It's all just so much easier nowadays.
What happens with the copyright for these movies when you're remixing them into something new?
Well, yeah, I work on loads of different things. So for the stuff on YouTube, it tends to be that a lot of film companies have made blanket arrangements with YouTube. So what happens is when a film company notices that a tiny fragment of their films are in your mix, then they put an advert on it, and I haven't had a takedown since like 2006.
That's pretty cool. So do you think the film industry is relaxing slightly in the realisation also? I mean, if you're using older movies, then you're highlighting something that they might be able to sell again.
Actually, honestly, I felt like that for a long time the film industry haven't had a problem with it. It's more musical people who have a problem with the way then who are defensive about it. Because the film people, like a lot of these films, are using 2-second clips. No spoilers in them. It's not really ruining the plot. All it's doing is creating an advert for people to go and rent and see your movie.
When you watch movies for relaxation, do you think you see them in a much different way? I mean, you must pay attention to things that most of us maybe don't even tune into.
Yeah, absolutely. I find myself like accidentally memorizing movies. So like when I did a mix recently, which was like 50 years of Doctor Who, and I found myself watching literally 200-300 episodes of Doctor Who, and then realizing that there was a whole theme that had ran through 10 episodes and going back and finding it. And it's like kind of like my mind had heard it, but not heard it.
In which case, if we want to take a look at what you've done and see all of the hacker stereotypes through the history of film, it seems, and indeed catch up with Doctor Who for 50 years, where can we find this online?
Well, everything is at eclecticmethod.net, which takes you to the Tumblr, which takes you to everything. Twitter, SoundCloud, YouTube, the usual places.
Johnny Wilson of Eclectic Method there. Surely it's time for some new hacker heroes to be placed more prominently in film, alongside the girl with the dragon tattoo, and hopefully ones that don't all live in a basement. I'm going to play us out with some of that supercut in a moment, but before I do, some news on this topic that's rather exciting. Matthew C. Applegate, who we know as the chiptune artist Pixelhate, is working on a comic book called The Developers. It covers some of the topics that we've discussed here, and more, and it should be coming out in the summer, so rest assured that I'll be chasing Matthew down to tell us all about it. For now, though, sit back and chuckle while we reminisce over some old-school keyboard clattering and some dial-up modems.
They shut down before we could complete our trace.
Shall we play a game?
Overload phone lines, email systems, disrupt air traffic.
Take money from any bank hack into
the FBI.
Crash 1500 system.
You can crash it from here, man.
Have you been sneaking into the NCOM system?
Give me a KPRO 64 and a live dial tone, and I can do anything.
I can do more damage on my laptop sitting in my pajamas.
Call me Circuit Breaker.
On digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5live.